Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is A.B. Dowji, and of course, this is The Big Picture, broadcasting simultaneously on Radio Islam and Radio Al Ansar. So, how's it, eh? But first, an update. I'm still getting many calls from people who are inquiring about my health. And there are some who heard that I passed away. So sorry to disappoint you. Well, the news is that I am alive and kicking, alhamdulillah. Yes, to recap, about 10 days ago, I had quite a stroke. Right arm, right leg, and speech went completely dead. My dear friend Idris Kamisa, whose home I was visiting, rushed me to hospital where they acted very fast and saved me from any permanent damage. Alhamdulillah. One may call it a stroke of luck. Alhamdulillah. Did you get that? So, apparently I had a clot in my brain that was causing some blockages, and so they managed to dissolve it, and now my brain is normal again, although some may say that it was never normal at any time. Dr. Khan, the neurologist, he did a first-class job. He did a full service, an oil change, wheel balancing, and alignment, and he even adjusted the wipers. That's right. And set the radio. So, back to normal, alhamdulillah. Feeling on top of the world. What did I say? Feeling on top of the world. Where I'll be next week, inshallah, on top of the world in Norway, with 49 people in my group making maja, watching the northern lights, doing some reindeer sledging, skiing, jollying in the snow, chasing the polar bears, and all of that stuff. And of course, meeting the Muslim community in Oslo and in Tromso and in Bergen, inshallah. And maybe like Riel Mafatiha is being invited to catch a chow with maybe a lekker post-Juma dal and rice jol. I don't know if they have that stuff there. Okay, now to some very serious issues. What's the issue dominating the headlines? Yes, there's only one. Not long ago here in South Africa, we had one big health problem, a scare. The Poloni crisis, remember? Poloni crisis. And now, we have another one. The tinfish crisis. But of course, the whole world is gripped by the coronavirus crisis. And of course, it's a very serious matter. And there are a whole lot of stories and theories floating around. America created the virus artificially and somehow transferred it to China so that it would create havoc and thereby destroy its economy. And then, on the converse side, China created the virus so that it would reach America and create havoc and thereby destroy Donald Trump's re-election ambition. Lots of things going around like that. One I just came across a few minutes ago is that a dog in Hong Kong has been infested with the coronavirus. The dog named Pomeranian is owned by Chow Hai Yi, who had previously been diagnosed with the virus. A shocking one is reported in the British Daily Mail newspaper that Pope Francis, did you get that? Pope Francis is very sick after he greeted and prayed for patients with the daily coronavirus. On Wednesday, the Pope was pictured coughing and wiping his nose while officiating Ash Wednesday service. So, there you are. Many stories, some factual and some extremely bizarre. By the way, the story about the Pope is absolutely 100% true. I saw it in the British Daily Mail with photographs of the Pope and all of that. So, let's try to get to what is actually it's all about. Let's try to see what it's all about. Okay? I went to the British Guardian newspaper website and found something quite interesting. And the headline reads, "Yes, it is worse than flu, busting the coronavirus myths." That means the stories around the coronavirus. Right? This means getting to the actual truth. What's it all about? The facts about what it's about. So let's look at the claims. And the newspaper says, claim, it is no more dangerous than winter flu. That is one of the claims. Now, it says many individuals who get coronavirus will experience nothing worse than seasonal flu symptoms. But the overall profile of the disease, including its mortality rate, looks more serious. In other words, it's very much it's got all the flu symptoms, but it is worse than that. At the start of an outbreak, the apparent mortality rate can be overestimated if a lot of mild cases are being missed. But this week, a World Health Organization expert suggested that this has not been the case with this virus. That's Bruce Aylward. He says he led an international mission to China to learn about the virus, and the country's response said the evidence did not suggest that we were only seeing the tip of the iceberg. In other words, it's fairly limited. That's what he's saying. It's not tip of the iceberg, like it's a huge number. If borne out by further testing, this could mean that current estimates of a roughly 1% fatality rate are accurate. So, let me just translate that. What he says is that, yes, there is a huge number in China, but even there, the mortality there, the death rate is only 1% of the people who've got the coronavirus. Okay, let's look at the next claim. It only kills the elderly, so younger people can relax. And he says, yeah, most people who are not elderly and do not have underlying health conditions will not become critically ill from the virus. Right? So that's an important thing. If you're healthy, you probably just get the flu kinds of symptoms. You'll probably be bedridden for a while, take your medication, and so on. Claim number 3, face masks don't work. Now, let's look at that claim. Wearing a face mask is not an ironclad guarantee that you won't get sick. Viruses can also transmit through the eyes and tiny viral particles known as aerosols. Can penetrate the mask. However, masks are effective at capturing droplets, which is the main transmission route of the virus. And some studies have estimated a roughly 5-fold protection versus no bad. If you are likely to be in close contact with someone infected, a mask cuts the chance of the disease being passed on. If you are just walking around town and not in close contact with others, wearing a mask is unlikely to make any difference. So, there you are, walking around town, open spaces, and so on. Here's another claim. You need to be with an infected person for 10 minutes. It says, for flu, some hospital guidelines define exposure as being within 6 feet of an infected person who sneezes or coughs for 10 minutes or longer. However, it is possible to be infected with shorter interactions or even by picking the virus up from contaminated surfaces and so on. I was in the hospital about 10 days ago, and there was a guy in the next bed who had severe pneumonia. Apparently, he had the flu for some time, didn't treat it all that well, went out, didn't take medication, and so on. That's the story I got. And that led to something even more serious. So he was in a pretty bad shape with pneumonia. So if you have this kind of, if you have the virus, coronavirus perhaps, then you need to do the usual thing, bed rest, and take the necessary medication, and so on. Here's another claim. A vaccine could be ready within a few months. Well, scientists were quick out of the gates in beginning to develop a vaccine for the new coronavirus, helped by the early release of the genetic sequence by Chinese research. So, they've analyzed this coronavirus already, and now they're working on a vaccine. And I just read a few minutes ago that Israel is very advanced and could be releasing a vaccine in a very, very short time. So, there you are. That is the story of the coronavirus. Right. So, there you are. Some information about the virus. I was listening to a professor from Harvard University 2 days ago who said that the majority of the fatalities, the deaths, are in China because This really amazed me. He said, because they are already predisposed to lung problems, because China has the highest number of heavy smokers in the world. Did you get that? And therefore, because their lungs are in very poor condition, the virus contributes to respiratory problems, and therefore, it's very, very dangerous, and therefore the outcome has been fatal. He further stated that the vast majority of those who contracted the virus with flu-like symptoms and with the common medication will recover with no adverse effects if they had the common flu, the type that we are familiar with. So, yes, with treatment and so on, most of them have recovered. So, as was stated, the mortality rate, meaning death rate from getting the virus, is around 1%. And this has mainly happened in China. But let's see how this has impacted on a very important aspect of Muslim life, Hajj and Umrah. And for the latest on that, we now speak to the well-known tour operator and activist, my friend Nazir Malik. Nazir Malik is in the studio with me. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam, A.B. Dawji. What an honor to be with you on air. You know, I always look up to you with you and your programs. I love the humor in your programs. And I like the way you downplaying this corona thing.
Well, I'm stating it all from the Guardian newspaper, which seems to be way ahead of anything that I can say.
Okay, Mr. Abidal.
So, what's happening about the current situation regarding Umrah and perhaps the longer view about Hajj?
Okay, first and foremost, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh to all the listeners of Radio Islam and which other medium that's connected to Radio Islam today. The coronavirus has affected everybody in the travel fraternity. Every travel agent is affected because, in my estimation, from the stats that we took from all agents yesterday, I think for the period from now, which is from last week, until the end of March, we have almost 3,000 passengers that would be traveling for Umrah. And considering the fact that it is the school holidays from the 18th of March, everybody have obviously made plans to go out for Umrah. By the way, the Umrah system, the visa system is currently suspended. You cannot apply for an Umrah visa because the system is closed. Prior to that, for 1 week, prior to the 27th, the Umrah system had a glitch. And people, approximately 400 people, could not travel prior to that. But that was the technical problem, and now it's become a coronavirus problem. How does this impact on everybody? Excuse me. Of course, what we've been informed by Saudi, the main carriers, which is Saudi Airlines, and of course Emirates Airlines, is that until the 12th of March, no airline will carry any passengers that are scheduled to go for Umrah on an Umrah visa. I'm making this very clear. No passengers holding an Umrah visa will be able to travel from now till the 12th of March. So basically what we are saying is that if you have plans from now until the 12th of March, you will need to cancel your Umrah trip. What happens to your cancellation? Yes, we've made South African Muslim Travel Association, of which I'm a representative, And we have made representation to the airlines, the mainstream carriers, which is Saudi Airlines and Emirates Airlines. And they have assured us that they will reissue those tickets at no additional cost for further dates. Maybe? This is very important.
Yes, of course.
If somebody wants to postpone their dates for a further date, they will reissue those tickets for that further date.
Excellent.
At no additional reissue cost. Okay?
Right.
But you know, there's also another thing. If you bought a ticket on an X class, and the date that you choose to travel might be an M class.
Right.
So the difference in fare will be borne by you, but the reissue, there will be no charge. Okay?
Okay?
So it depends on the date that you choose and your class is available. The airline will issue your tickets at no additional cost. So for that, you need to contact your local agent that you've booked your tickets with, and he or she will do the necessary arrangements. Further to...
I'm very worried that you're coughing and sneezing, yeah?
Yeah. You should be. But I haven't been to China, so it's fine. Okay. Further to that, if you want to cancel your trip, if you cannot make it, for instance, you've taken leave from your workplace and you want to cancel your trip, then for that reason, remember, your ticket is valid for 1 year.
Right.
So if you can plan yourself, if you can't make it now, and you can plan yourself for a year from now, within the year period, then you'll be able to reschedule your ticket. Alternately, you can cancel your ticket, and you'll be able to get a full refund from the airline if it is by coronavirus affection.
Right.
If it's affected, your travel is affected by coronavirus, then you'll be able to do so. One very important thing, AB, whilst we're at this topic, you know, you and I, we need to emphasize how important it is for every person that's traveling to any destination in the world to please take out travel insurance. Another important factor when people speak about they having their credit cards and issuing their tickets against their credit cards, please remember, when you do group travels and group tickets are issued, normally the airline does not accept your credit card. Am I right, Avi?
Correct.
So, in those cases, please, and also in the cases where you, even if you use your credit card insurance on travel is but limited. Very limited. So you must either take up a top-up cover and see if it adequately covers you. So I appeal to every person that's traveling throughout the world, wherever you may be traveling, to please make sure you take out travel insurances. And those that have taken out travel insurances have a right to claim from your travel insurance company for whatever delays or curtailments that you might have experienced in this trip. Now let's go to another important factor, Amy. People that were supposed to travel this week and next week, obviously they are going to cancel because the airline refuses to take anybody on because it's a directive that they've received from the Ministry of Umrah and Hajj and of course from the Ministry of Health in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Right.
And the reason for this delay, as we all well know, is to build up these isolation centers at all entry points in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Be it the airport or be it the points of even the border post by land, in whichever way, even the checkpost in Medina too.
In other words, what you are saying is that first there's going to be a screening process. All countries are going to have strict screening processes at the entry points.
100%.
And thereafter, if they feel that somebody's got a heavy fever or something like that, then they're going to put them in quarantine. Until they're cleared.
Yes.
And they are shown not to have that particular virus. Right.
Okay? So it reduces the risk. We don't say the risk is not there, because you know, and I know, and we all know, that if you are infected with the coronavirus, it can only surface after 15 days.
Right.
So that's still not, but at least it's a precautionary measure that they are taking right now.
Right.
Okay? So, be there that is may, lots of people have been getting these WhatsApps saying that this situation will normalize in 48 hours.
Hmm.
From the time that notice came out, it is a hoax. It's 48 hours gone by, and nothing has changed in the situation. We've been in touch with the Umrah companies. We, as SAMHSA, have been in touch with medical associations. We've been in touch with airlines and the operators in the kingdom. And we're all in the hope that this should be normalized as soon as possible. But how, we don't know how soon.
Right. So as soon as you get word of it, then of course, obviously,
we will then disseminate information. We are hopeful that we get some information by tomorrow. As you know, in the kingdom, Thursday, Friday and Saturday, nothing is achieved. And Sunday becomes the day that they're all in operation. So all ministries will be in operation after that. With respect to the accommodation that is booked, there's three aspects to this trip of Umrah, remember. One is a visa, which you have paid. Second is accommodation. And thirdly, it is the airfare that you've paid for. Right. We've discussed the airfare portion. Now let's come to the visa portion. There's words out by the Umrah company that if your visa expires before the Umrah season or this crisis is...
Yeah, at the time when you are leaving.
At the time you are leaving, then there's words out that they might extend those visas. But like you and I know, there's got to be a process. And how that process unfolds, we don't know. We're all waiting to hear.
We've got a couple of question marks there.
We've got a couple of question marks. Right? So it may not just happen the day that it opens up that tomorrow you may be able to travel if your visa is expired.
Right.
Because you must remember, those visas had 15 days entry into the kingdom and 30 days stay in the kingdom.
Right.
That's a very important clause, AB.
Okay.
It's a very important clause.
Yeah.
Now, 15 days you had from the date your visa was issued to enter the kingdom, and you had a 30-day stay in the kingdom. Now, let me tell you what happened as of the last night and the night before. Medina, people came in from Medina, and as a result, at the check post, they were returned back to Medina. They were not allowed to enter Makkah.
Hmm.
Airlines that landed on the 27th morning after midnight returned back to their destinations.
Right.
So this is quite serious. Okay, they are taking it seriously. With respect to the accommodation, we've been speaking to the operators that we've taken rooms from in the kingdom, and we don't have a guarantee that they will give us full refund. We're hoping, we're trying to negotiate with them, because you must remember the operator has already paid the hotel.
Right.
The hotel rooms are still now sitting empty.
And this is a completely new scenario. It has never happened before.
Yeah, it's never happened before. So this could happen to any operator, to any destination.
Yeah.
If you do not want to travel, it is not the fault of the operator that he has already paid his dues to the operator. If you take it the other way around, if the operator did not pay, then you would have been in trouble. Your room wouldn't have been secured. You understand?
Yes, yes.
So it's a two-way stream. Mm. So we need the public to please bear with the operators. We will keep you updated. SAMHSA itself, it will be taking every step possible to now go and make sure that we get full refunds from wherever possible the service provider may be. Maybe just to give you an update.
Yes.
Currently there are 50 countries, more than 50 actually.
Mm.
Affected by the coronavirus.
Yeah, one in Nigeria, I heard also. Yeah.
Even they said 4 in South Africa today.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
85,000 as per the stats that's declared. What's declared, we don't know.
Mm.
And coming back to your theory of 1.some%, it's now gone to 3.5%.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, what we're saying is that, you know, people want to know where can they travel? Where can they travel to? So far, Malaysia seems to be clear. Mauritius seems to be clear. Your local tour seems to be clear.
Amzinto
seems to be clear. Yeah, all we can do is make dua, inshallah.
Inshallah.
Allah contains this entire thing. And please keep in touch with your local travel operator. And SAMHSA, as a South African Muslim Travel Association, will keep you updated as news unfold.
Nazir Malik, Jazakallah for giving us that update. We make dua that the situation improves and that all those who packed and are ready to go will inshallah have their dreams fulfilled.
Fulfilled inshallah.
Right,
Jazakallah khair.
Jazakallah for being on the program.
A pleasure.
A quick break. Right, welcome back. The program, as you know, is The Big Picture, and there you had an update from Nazir Malik, and he gave me some good news that Norway is clear. So I'll be away from all of this and making maja in Norway inshallah next week. Right, so the situation is a bit frightening around here. Let's now look at other stories making international headlines. This week, the trial of Julian Assange began in London. But before I get there, let me just see what else I've got for you here. Let me cross over to see what's happening in India at this stage. In India, yeah. Lots of trouble's been happening there over the last couple of weeks, if not months. And to unpack all of that for us, we have on the line Mustafa Darsot, who is quite familiar to the listeners of The Big Picture. Mustafa, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Mustafa Darsot?
Fine now, EB. Well, you're on air, so that should be good.
Right. I got you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam, can you hear me?
I can hear you now, yes. Unpack for us exactly what's happening in India, what has happened, and give us up-to-date information.
Okay, AB, to be blunt, right, the question to ask is India sleepwalking towards a Muslim Holocaust, right? And we all know the Holocaust was the last century's tragedy that left unbearable losses and stains on the face of Europe. And is this happening again in secular India? Of course, Europe has been always secular, right? Indian Muslims are experiencing the same set of denunciation as the Jews faced under the Nazi regime. Exclusion from mainstream society, racial profiling based upon belief, and negative media representation and bigotry. You take the Bollywood films, right? Okay, they are showing the Muslims as gangsters, dons, smugglers, terrorists, anti-state actors, similar to what Hollywood would show, or should I say, sorry, not Hollywood, the German films showed at the time how they were, Jews as bad guys, right, during the Nazi rule. And what we see here are the parallels of the RSS, which is actually behaving like the Nazis right now, okay? And they are spitting their propaganda and are portraying the Muslims in such a bad light that even if one has to ask, I mean, this sort of hypocrisy, they'll turn around and say, what hypocrisy? Take Erdogan, yes, made a very strong statement against the of what is happening in India at the moment. And he said that, you know, who are being targeted? It's Muslims. Who is carrying it out? It's Hindus, right? And then immediately getting a rebuke. At the same time, the OIC made a statement condemning what's happening in India. And one of the ministers turned on and said, oh, it's a very harsh statement, you know, it's an internal matter, etc. And that's the typical narrative, of course, we see from our cousins there in Israel, right? So this is what's happening in India. And then when you get leading politicians like Amit Shah, who is the BJP president and who is the home minister for India, right? When they make statements like, Goli Maro, right, means shoot them. Then another word says, Deshke Gadai Roko, right, means traitors of the country. And put that together, Goli Maro, Deshke Gadai Roko, means shoot the traitors of the country. And those were the slogans that have been chanted in the course of this month. Now, if anything that is incendiary and hateful, this is what is happening right now in India. And it all stemmed up from what happened earlier in the week. Of course, we know Trump went to India last Sunday, and of course it was expected that people are going to use this opportunity, being a high-profile state visit, to come out on the streets like they have been doing since the Citizenship Amendment Bill, CAB, was announced, right, and then followed by the CAA, where you've been seeing ongoing protests throughout the major cities in India. But this is an opportunity to let the world know, by using the state visit, what is happening. But of course, the RSS responded harshly, and it started off with this guy, Mishra character, who was one of the BJP leaders, who saw that the Muslims were blocking a major road on the northwestern part of the city, and sent the goons after, and the whole thing just went out of hand. Burning of property, houses, food stalls, shops, cars, motorcycles. 200 to 300 people have been injured over, now the death toll sits at about 35 at the moment, but that's also understated. This is what's happening right now in India.
So, what do you envisage is going to happen in days to come?
Well, look, the thing is that the situation is very tense. Of course, I mean, the thing is that there's been, the people are fed up, and what we are seeing is that we are seeing a united front of people. It's, I mean, you get people who, you get a food, say, for example, a food stall seller, you know, a Muslim whose stall was burned, but right next to him was a Hindu, and he was also targeted because they happened to be together. So, I mean, these thugs, when they did, I mean, yes, they will differentiate whenever they can, and you are seeing a replica of the 2002 Gujarat riots, which took place where about 2,000 people were killed, mercilessly killed. And if one has to look at an article that was written now recently in the latest issue of Time magazine by known Kashmiri Indian journalist Rana Ayub, who also is the author of the Gujarat Files. And she has said, she's actually saying that she's titled this article, Narendra Modi Looks the Other Way as New Delhi Burns. And she said that this is, you are seeing the exact parallels of Gujarat being repeated, whereby when Gujarat riots are taking place, Modi did absolutely nothing. He just looked the other way. And, I mean, he even, but nothing stopped him from making incendiary comments. For example, he said that you know, he was mocking the riot victims and calling the relief camps that were set up for Muslims as child-producing factories. Right? Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at what Amit Shah is saying, he calls the so-called illegals from Bangladesh or the so-called illegals from the Bengal region into India as termites. And he says that they deserve to be thrown into the Bay of Bengal. Now, you've seen all this happening, and it's just getting worse and worse. Trump was in India this week. What did Trump do? What did Trump say? Nothing. In fact, when he was asked about it at a press conference, he says that he actually sidestepped the issue. And he said that the Prime Minister, referring to Modi, was incredible in what he told me. He wants people to have religious freedom, and very strongly. That's absolute nonsense, we know. And he even added to this, he said, I've heard about the violence, but that was up to India to handle. Right? So, maybe if you look at the current trend at the moment, you've got Trump in the United States, you've got Bolsonaro in Brazil, Boris Johnson in the UK, Netanyahu in Israel, MBS in Saudi Arabia, Putin in Russia, Xi Jinping in China, and you got Modi in India. This is the era of right-wing fascism, and where you see fascism unites. And the bromance, I mean, what did this whole thing with Trump's visit to India do? What did it really achieve? It was basically a good spectacle to fool the world that, you know, as leaders of world's largest democracy and world's oldest democracy, right, largest democracy being India, oldest democracy being the United States, coming together and being, you know, admired. And that's what's happening. If you took a look at the trade deals that happened, I mean, a silly trade deal of about $3 billion for arms, which is a child's play compared to what they sell to the Middle Eastern countries. When Trump went in 2017 on his first high-profile visit out of the United States, which was into Saudi Arabia, he bragged about $100 billion arms. Mm-hmm. Right? So the thing is that here you've seen that, and of course we know that the common agenda, in fact, I was in India in January 2018 at the time when Netanyahu visited India. In fact, I was in Bombay, right, when in that week when he was there. And when we were walking on the streets there in Colaba, and then suddenly we saw a large police presence, and they told everybody, right, go into the shops and don't walk on the street until we tell you people to. So suddenly you saw the entire street quiet, no street sellers, nothing, everybody in the shops. Then you see this large motorcade passes by. And in there was a Mercedes-Benz S-Class where you see Modi and Netanyahu in the back seat. Right? Now, what I'm trying to say is that even that visit to India too, if I could recall, even the, you saw all over, you saw posters, you saw this and that about, you know, India, Israel, a new era, what Netanyahu said, it is a marriage made in heaven, you know, you saw that whole hype about it, right? But when people talking on the ground saying, hey, but really speaking, what are they trying to achieve? What are they trying to do? You know, yet we didn't know that actually speaking, that all this was obviously 2018 visit by Netanyahu to India was followed by Modi's visit the year before to Israel. But this was all a plan to show that they were actually working on an agenda, and a terrible agenda, because once the BJP was re-elected in May 2019, you saw now that entire agenda unfolding, starting with Kashmir in August, followed by the Assam NRC, saga, but the ruling of the High Supreme Court on Babri Masjid, and then of course the CAB followed by the CAA.
Yes, and you can call it a marriage of the bigots, and that's where we'll have to leave it. Excellent analysis there from Mustafa Darsod. Jazakallah khair for that input, Mustafa.
Okay, AB. Okay.
Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. As I said, a very frightening situation indeed. Make dua for the nightmare to end soon, inshallah. Let's now look at other stories making international headlines. This week was the trial of Julian Assange. It began in London. The hearing was about extraditing him to the United States to stand trial for what they call spying, or more accurately, for getting hold of United States government secret documents and revealing them to the world. That is basically the short story. In case you don't know who is Julian Assange, let me give you a brief background. Julian Assange was born in July 1971. He's an Australian editor, publisher and activist who founded WikiLeaks in 2006. WikiLeaks came to international attention in 2010 when it published a series of leaks provided by U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning. These leaks included the collateral murder video. I don't want to go into that. The Afghan war logs, the Iraq war logs, the cable gate, and so on. Many other things. So, to cut a long story short, he exposed the crimes of the United States, which were regarded as top secret, and America wants London to send him to the U.S. to stand trial, which could mean life imprisonment. Many right-thinking people, people of conscience, people of justice, are outraged that he was jailed in Britain and tortured and have been calling for his release. Very, very prominent people. And 3 days ago, there was a public meeting where very important people spoke out. Amongst them was George Galloway. Of course, you know him. He pulls no punches. A straight talker. And so I got a clip of his speech, which I'm going to play for you right now. Please listen very carefully.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for coming all the way from Moscow to be with us tonight. And that was an excellent speech, I'm sure you'll all agree. Now, here we had a conservative. And would you call George Galloway a conservative?
No!
But we, an imperialist in Montreal, are a broad church. And as imperialists worldwide know, we are also a broad church. We're tolerant of others that have difference of opinions. Some people here have different views on social issues. Some are more conservative, some are more liberal. The same with economics. We generally all be very much on the left, but sometimes there are people like Peter that are more conservative, and that's fair enough. But what we're all driven by is a passion for peace and anti-imperialism and anti-neoliberalism. That's free speech too. Thank you. So, could I welcome our fifth speaker here, Mr. George Galloway.
Thank you. Gregor, I hope you didn't mean that I'm a liberal. Honourable Craig Murray, my RT colleague, Peter Lavelle, Honourable Speakers, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, this is a magnificent event attended by people, as Greg said, of different political stripes, but united in solidarity with prisoner number A9379AY, the world historic figure, Julian Assange. I just want to, in parenthesis, make this point. I said the Honourable Craig Murray. All of the speakers are honourable. But he is right honourable. You see, people like me had no choice but to take this path. We were born into it. We had no alternatives. The struggle against imperialism was the only choice that we had. But Craig Murray had a glittering career in the British Foreign Office. Her Majesty's ambassador to Uzbekistan. And he threw it all away because he stood up for justice against torture, against disappearances, against political repression. He threw it all away. He could have kept his head down, been the ambassador for here and for there, and have a knighthood. Well, they may not give you a knighthood, but you'll always be Sir Craig Murray to me. Yes. 10 years ago, exactly on this day, I was kidnapped by the thugs of the dictator Hosni Mubarak, who died today. I was kidnapped in the dead of night. I was taken by men without uniform who couldn't speak English, even if they had wanted to tell me who they were and where they were taking me. They drove me for many hours, I knew not where, and deposited me at the airport in Cairo, served me with the certificate, which I proudly hold, a blue paper, declaring me persona non grata and no longer welcome in Egypt. And I have to tell you that the legal proceedings as described here this evening and in the various blogs, because that's the only place you're going to read anything substantive about what's going on in blogs like Craig Murray's and many others, these legal proceedings would have been more fitting in Hosni Mubarak's dictatorship in Egypt than in a country like Britain, which is supposed to be a Western democracy. Who cannot tremble with indignation at what happened to Julian Assange just yesterday? Never mind over the last decade. Just yesterday, this man, who should be in Oslo getting the Nobel Peace Prize, was being stripped and searched by goons, handcuffed, held in 5 different cells in one day. Handcuffed 11 times. Handcuffed for what? He was in a bulletproof box all day in the court. What were they searching him up his backside for? Why did they take his legal papers away? Talk about an abuse of process. This is an obscenity in a country that pretends to believe in the rule of law and justice. Who cannot tremble with indignation when we learn that every movement, literally, Craig, every time we went to the toilet in the Ecuadorian embassy, the CIA were watching it on video. I'm not exaggerating. There was a camera in the toilet where Pamela Anderson peed, where Craig Murray and me and others who have the honor to be friends of Julian Assange, but much more importantly than our movements, they spied on every legal meeting that Julian had with his representatives in absolute brazen defiance of the rules of justice and the lawyer-client privilege. As Craig pointed out, in any other, if you were in court because your dog had fouled the pavement, and this kind of abuse of process was unveiled by the defense, the case would be thrown out immediately. No trial can take place when it's been corrupted from the beginning. in this way, who cannot tremble with indignation at the idea that the... I'm coming to that point. Who cannot tremble with indignation at the idea that the man that blew the whistle on the war crimes is in Belmarsh and the war criminals are on the BBC and ITV and raking in millions and millions and millions and millions of pounds? The criminals have made it a crime to report on the crimes that they committed. Ponder that. That's now the country that we are living in. Who cannot tremble with indignation? Well, 95% at least of Britain's journalists didn't even show up today to hear the defence's argument. 95% of Britain's broadcasters are not trembling with indignation. If you cannot tremble with indignation at any injustice anywhere, you are not a human being. You have no pulse and you have no soul. And that's the reality of the so-called fourth estate in this country. I spit upon them. This church should be bulging with journalists, because if they had any intention of actually doing their job, what is happening to Julian Assange is a mortal danger to them. It's a knife at their heart. It's a sword of Damocles hanging over their heads. If they ever intended to actually be journalists. But of course, the truth is, most of them have sold whatever soul they had just for a ribbon to put on their coat, just for a shilling or two. They have abandoned any claim of moral authority. And these are the people that lecture us, especially election times. Speaking of which, on the principle that it's better late than never, I'm glad that Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell have finally found a voice to speak up in favour of Julian Assange. And if they'd done so earlier, we might have been further down the road to getting Julian out of Belmarsh. Now, I only have time to make two more quick points. And again, they relate to what the Honourable Craig Murray said. You see, I was there when this extradition treaty was reached. It was concluded behind the backs of Parliament, during the summer recess, when no member of Parliament could question the treaty which David Blunkett, Tony Blair's Home Secretary, corruptly and secretly concluded with the United States. A one-sided extradition treaty, the likes of which no free country would ever sign with any other country, where they'd never have to send anybody to us, whatever they've done, even if it's killing a young boy on a motorway because you're driving up the wrong side of the roads. You don't have to send anybody to us. But we will send anybody to you without even just cause having to be produced. But when Parliament returned in the autumn, I bearded David Blunkett in the members' lobby and told them all the things that I thought were wrong and dangerous with this extradition treaty. And he said to me, "You're worrying unnecessarily because all of the points you're making are taken care of by Article 4.1 of the treaty, which precludes the extradition of people in Britain for political offences to the United States. And now the judge is telling us that although that's on the face of the treaty, it does not apply. What madness is this? And the second point. Sorry?
Windrush. That's another meeting. I'll come back to that.
The last point then that I have time to make is this. If we allow, if the British public allows, if the British media allows, if the British political class allows, and remember this has to be rubber stamped, signed off by the current Home Secretary, Priti Patel. So public opinion has a role here. He cannot be sent from this country without a politician, an elected politician, a member of an elected government, signing the final extradition order. If we allow Julian Assange to be sent for the rest of his life, the rest of his life, into the dungeons of the US injustice system, journalism, freedom, freedom of speech, democracy itself will have been murdered in plain sight on our watch. And that's why we are going to fight and fight and fight again to free Julian Assange. Free Julian Assange.
Wow. I've heard many of electrifying speeches by George, but that one was something else. Bravo, George Galloway.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Something for everyone on your favorite learning station. This is Radio Islam International.
Muhammadun Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
Well, there you are. No one can say it like George Galloway. What a powerful voice, eh? There you have it, folks. The man who exposed America's crimes, Julian Assange, is now regarded as a criminal. This is the new world we are living in. So please watch this case very carefully. The whole world is focused on it, the trial of Julian Assange. Right, we got a minute and we're going to finish off by visiting the graveyard of the light at the end of the tunnel. But today I just got some serious stuff, some very thought-provoking stuff. As you know, I usually just delete messages that I get via SMS or email that are all sweet and sugary. You know, all those sayings and inspiring quotations and so on. But one I received recently was, well, I thought it was quite deep. This is what it said. Two things define you. Your patience when you have nothing and your attitude when you have everything. Wow. Let me repeat that. Two things define you. Your patience when you have nothing and your attitude when you have everything. There you are. Something to think about. Very deep stuff, ne? As I was checking the messages, I saw the sender had sent me another one, and this is it. If you want to create happiness, then seek that which enriches your life. If you want to create happiness, then seek that which enriches your life. But if you want to experience happiness, then help others enrich theirs. How is that, eh? Well, that's all for now. This is A.B. Dawji bidding you all. Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. And more of this in part 2 on Radio Al-Ansar, inshallah.